Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be looking even more at what's the matter with Kansas and what might be going right. Also, shocking news, Lila Rose is making stuff up again. And Phoebe Potts will be on to talk about her new book on infertility. Andy Cobb responded to the legalizing of gay marriage in New York by pleading with conservatives to hang up the gay marriage is unnatural argument, just on the grounds of silliness.
If we look at what's natural, we might look to our closest relative in nature, the bonobo chimpanzee. And they're like nature's little penetration machines. They f*** it all. Boys, girls, relatives, before, during, and after meals. It's how they say hello, goodbye, and pretty much everything else. A truly natural approach to marriage means a nonstop, all-comer, scat-friendly mega-orgy with every member of your social network, in every conceivable combination and orifice. Now that is getting tagged on Facebook. So argue away, folks, but please don't tell me what's natural. If we were really doing what's natural, I couldn't even be saying this to you right now, because your genitals would be stuffed in my mouth.
The whole thing was accompanied by a video proving how much bonobos spend pretty much every waking hour having sex with each other, sometimes even in three ways and definitely in homosexual pairings. No, I'm serious. They really do that. Last week, with Kate Shepard's help, I covered the extensive attacks on abortion clinics in Kansas. Regulations concocted strictly to shut down the clinics seemed like they were going to take out all three remaining clinics, and in fact, all three had their licenses revoked. But the state has since relented in the case of one clinic.
Peter Brownlie is the president of the Planned Parenthood of Kansas and Mid-Missouri. Peter, thank you very much. Your clinic is the only one to meet these requirements, and you are the only one opened in Kansas. You served, I believe it was around 8,000 women. My number could be wrong here in the state. And now you're the only one available to help them if these requirements stick.
That's correct. We just learned at the end of the day yesterday that our license application had been approved. We're pleased that we're able to provide service, but these regulations are unnecessary, burdensome, and clearly part of a political attempt to outlaw abortion in the state of Kansas.
I mean, when I bring up these requirements, the square footage of a janitor's closet, the size of staff dressing rooms, how is that relevant at all to what you provide to women every day in that state?
It's not relevant.
Here's my theory, though. It's mainly a theory, so feel free to disregard it. Even though it's clear and has been stated by some legislators that these regulations are only about making abortion illegal in the state of Kansas, the official excuse for the regulations is that they're there to protect women's health and that they're therefore not a violation of Roe versus Wade. But in shutting down all three clinics, no matter how much in compliance they are, made it too obvious that this has nothing to do with women's health. As soon as the clinic sued, Governor Sam Brownback and company realized their disingenuous claims that this is about protecting women instead of banning abortion wouldn't fly. So they allowed one clinic to have a license to establish plausible deniability. If they win the court case, this last clinic will be shut down, however, because the court has signed off on the new powers they've given themselves. So while I'm glad that at least one clinic in Kansas can continue to serve abortion patients, I must caution against being too happy about it. They're only operating, I suspect, because it's strategic for anti-choicers to allow it. But it won't last if the antis win their case. That said, there is good news.
Federal judge tonight has halted the attempt by the state of Kansas to turn back the clock and override Roe v. Wade. The state was down to one legal abortion provider for some 8,000 women who seek abortions there each year. This following a hardline bill signed by Republican Governor Sam Brownback that was meant to crack down on providers by making it physically difficult for clinics to obtain licenses. Responding to a lawsuit by two doctors, the judge in Topeka has issued a restraining order on the draconian regulations, one that he says will stay in effect until the suit is settled.
That a federal judge stays a law doesn't mean that it will be overturned. However, It does mean that it's a bit more likely to be the case, and at least means that this law is considered drastic enough that it has to be stayed while it gets hashed out. Also, women in Kansas won't suffer the dramatic loss in services that they would have otherwise. Or will they? The health department in Kansas is claiming they can create another set of permanent restrictions that are identical that won't be subject to this stay. We'll see. Chris Matthews did some great coverage of this, including interviewing Nancy Northup, the president of the Center for Reproductive Rights. The center is basically managing the clinic lawsuits against Kansas.
Is absolutely an attempt to outlaw abortion in the state of Kansas. These are medically unnecessary rules that were put into place in a kind of bogus procedural way, and our clients are not going to be able to provide abortion services tomorrow morning until we get into court tomorrow afternoon.
So what happens? I mean, I'm not going to make the argument here. Let you make the argument. You're the advocate. But it seems to me it puts women who want to have an abortion in a double choice situation. Travel out of state or go to someone who does it illegally.
Well, absolutely.
That's effectively where it's going to come to, isn't it?
The harm of these laws is that they hurt women. And, you know, one in three women in the United States has an abortion in her lifetime.
He also interviewed journalist Laura Bassett about why the supporters of these laws are, well, liars. I really liked this part because Matthews didn't pull his punches when it came to characterizing the disingenuous claims that these laws are there to somehow protect women. Yeah, in the same way poll taxes were there to protect black citizens from having to vote.
It's like literacy tests in the South.
Exactly.
It's not exactly parallel, but it's the kind of game you said. Now, my question is, are they admitting that this is a game, a strategy to kill abortion rights in Kansas?
Our Republicans are not admitting it. They're saying it's to protect women's health. They're saying it's to protect women's safety, that these clinics aren't safe. But doctors are saying that these regulations aren't even being used for hospitals and surgery centers. And an abortion procedure is much less invasive than many other surgical procedures that don't have these same regulations. And so it raises a few questions.
I highly recommend the whole segment. He really drills down into how much this law is being justified in bad faith and how unconstitutional all this is. I've made fun of Chris Matthews before for some of his silly sexist moments, but he did a really thorough job in covering this issue.
I'd like to welcome Phoebe Potts to the program. Phoebe recently published her first graphic novel to much critical acclaim. It's called Good Eggs, and it's about her and her husband's journey to become parents and so much more. She's here today to talk about her book and the all-too-common struggle with infertility. Welcome to RealityCast, Phoebe.
Thank you so much for having me.
Infertility is such a personal thing, and you're very brave for coming out with your story. What inspired you to do it?
It wasn't bravery. It's just narcissism. I like to talk about myself, and so if something's happening to me, I talk about it loudly and regularly. So I'm an artist. I love to draw pictures. I like to tell stories, and as I said, particularly ones in which I'm the star. And so it was a natural thing to do, to draw and write about the structured insanity of infertility treatments. And it grew into sort of the story of my life.
And what do you mean by the structured insanity?
Well, people who have done fertility treatments will know what I mean. And for those who haven't, and I hope people never have to, it's every part of your cycle is sort of taken over by medicine and science. And so you're zorching yourself up with hormones like a pro ball player, and you're having your insides inspected on a regular basis. And it's structured because it's all on a schedule, and it's all on a schedule that the doctor sets. It's insanity because, well, your hormones are doing what they do, and you're on a constant cycle, not to overuse the word, of hope and despair, which can drive you insane. It did me. I mean, you know, in a very quiet way, but it did me.
Well, and one of the things that has struck me about talking to people that have gone through experiences like yours is that once you're deep in the world of infertility treatments, it seems very surreal.
Right.
Like, very unnatural. Can you kind of talk about that a little?
Yeah, there's a part in the book where Jeff and I, with my husband, have just left the one of our embryo transfer appointments. And I'm a little bit high because I've did the acupuncture, which they offer. And I like to say that I do anything that they offer because at a fertility clinic, you're a captive audience. If they said rub peanut butter on your shoulders, I do that because you're just so desperate to have a baby. Anyway, we're leaving, and Jeff is sort of lamenting about the process. And he goes, first, it's just you and me, meaning just a couple in bed having a wonderful romantic or maybe not so romantic evening, just having sex. The second thing he says is, then it's you and me and the nurse with the turkey baster, and that's for intrauterine insemination. And he said, but now it feels like you and me and NASA, because there's so many people in the room trying to get you pregnant and all these machines humming and breathing and going, you know, and people coming in and looking at your most private areas. And it's true. It becomes not what we were sort of intended to do. And you have to sort of question it. Is this even right? I mean, I would ask myself a lot. I know I'm getting off your question, but I would ask myself a lot, like, maybe I'm the one who just doesn't get to have a baby. Like, why go through all these just incredibly complicated, expensive, and involved extra steps?
Well, and what do you think does motivate the desire to go through so much expense and pain to get there?
It's different for each person. I wanted to have a baby. I wanted to make it. I wanted to make it with Jeff. I love Jeff. We have a very strong marriage. It's the most important thing in the world to me, and it seemed natural that as artists and as people in love, we would then make this creation. I wanted to feel what it was like to be pregnant. I wanted to be in control of, as much as I could, of the health of the baby from the beginning, something that you kind of have to give up some of when you're involved in adoption. Or at least, you know, I mean, I know that childbirth and having your own baby is a humbling process too, and things can always go wrong or not as you had planned. But I also think that there's such the culture, and certainly the culture in Massachusetts where I live and where with the health insurance that I had, fertility treatments were paid for, is that no doctor, no counselor ever stopped me and said, hey, maybe you just don't do this. That there's this attitude that, of course you want to be a mother. And so there was never a question. And I sort of was buffeted along by the tide of this. When it was, when we weren't getting pregnant on our own and I was miscarrying, the doctors just said, okay, next stop, the infertility specialist. There was never a, if we were ever going to stop the train, we were going to have to stop the train. But there was this assumption from my primary care doctor all the way down the line, even to the insurance folks, that of course I would want to be a mother. Of course I would, but through, you know, biologically. I think if I lived in a different state, though, where infertility treatments weren't covered under insurance, and we were going to be spending a lot of our own money, which we didn't have, I think adoption would have come up a lot sooner.
And you're working on the adoption right now?
Yes. We've been in the adoption process for 3 years. It's an expensive nightmare. And that's also, I think, part of the reason why fertility treatments are really appealing to a lot of people, is that it's not that adoption is so easy and there's just as many people involved. But I am very pleased to say that we have just come back from our first of 2 trips to Ethiopia. We've met the baby boy we're matched with. He's healthy, he's happy, and we're feeling very fortunate right now.
Oh, that's wonderful news.
Yes, thanks.
So I want to talk a little bit about the role of humor in this book. Obviously, these are very painful events you're recounting, and yet your book is very funny. It's got a lot of laugh out loud moments. What do you think is the role of humor in telling a story like yours?
Well, I want you to read the book, and I think that if you just tell the long, sad story of how I couldn't have a baby, like, who would want to read that? I wouldn't want to read that. So I think humor can kind of leaven the experience. I also think that humor, it's a beautiful way to cope. It's a completely old, you know, time-tested strategy of coping with difficult things. I don't think it's a coincidence that I'm Jewish and that the Jewish tradition of suffering and humor are very closely linked. Well, I should say Judaism, humor, and storytelling are all really closely linked. And I think it's also just the way I like to see the world. I'm a particularly avid student of stand-up comics. I don't go to clubs, but I watch them a lot. And I find, like, Louis C.K. and Sarah Silverman, like, just incredibly useful people in our culture as a way of sort of looking at really difficult things, explaining them to us, and giving us the information in a way that we can kind of swallow it.
And your book really kind of expands far beyond just the direct experience of dealing with infertility, and you end up talking a lot about some of your past as a union organizer and also your spiritual journey. How has your spiritual journey been influenced by everything that has happened?
The fertility and I would also imagine just pregnancy and childbirth are just such humbling experiences. And the fertility stuff, I guess I just assumed, being white, middle class, overeducated, just I had this enormous sense of entitlement. And, you know, I eat my vegetables, I went to Smith, I do yoga, I married a nice Jewish boy. Like, why? Of course I would get pregnant. And then when I didn't, it was just so humbling, because it's such a, I thought it was such a basic thing, and I thought it was my right. And I think that that experience made me realize that I'm not in control of everything. Even though, I mean, I was raised in the feminist 70s in America, and so I was raised to think that the world was my oyster. But I think also being white and middle class has a lot to do with that feeling of entitlement. But anyway, it wasn't that I had a moment where, you know, I saw God or something. I just realized that I was one small thing of something much larger. And that thought was actually really useful. I also think that the more I got involved in Judaism, part of the reason it appealed to me so much is that it's all about questions and not so much about answers. And questions make us uncomfortable, certainly make me uncomfortable, but it was more realistic given what I was going through.
I think it's interesting when you say the word entitlement, because in a way it's a good thing that women feel entitled to have everything that they want.
That's right.
But obviously you can't always have everything that you want. What would you say to somebody who is going through a similar struggle of realizing that even though they're entitled to their entitlement, you know, sometimes you just can't have everything you want?
What would I say to that person? I would say I'm right there with you. I would say it sucks. I mean, it's confusing because Peggy Ornstein, who wrote this article for the New York Times a couple of years ago, I guess now, where she said, you know, women of my generation, but she didn't say this, but I always add, and my skin color and my social class, were raised to think you could have anything, and that is really good. But it shouldn't, and also just being an American, you think, well, if I work hard enough, I'll just get what I want. And I think sometimes the fertility treatments just kind of reinforce that, like, well, I'll just work really hard on my fertility treatments, I'll make sure I hit all my appointments, take the drugs at the right time, work really hard at this job I hate so I can have these insurance benefits. But then what that does is it puts an undue amount of the onus on you when you don't get pregnant. And sometimes you just don't get pregnant. I mean, I didn't start till I was 34. And the science says that, you know, at 35, your fertility drops way off. Like, it wasn't anybody's fault. But I think part of the problem is I thought that I could do anything if I wanted to do it, and if and I just had to make it happen. And so when it when I didn't get this thing that I thought I was entitled to, it wasn't, I didn't have that sort of sense of, it took a while for me to get that sense of humility, like, oh, like, I don't control all of this. I'm always going to be sad that I didn't get to make my own baby, but I'm not sad that I went through that experience.
That makes
sense. It's made me a little bit more empathetic. Not much. I still really like to judge people, really, but it's made me a little more empathetic.
My guest today has been Phoebe Potts, and her book is called Good Eggs. It's a memoir. It's a graphic novel, and it's available online and at your local bookstore. You can visit her website at phoebepotts.com. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast and sharing your story, Phoebe.
I had so much fun. Thank you.
Lila Rose is at it again with videos that purport to be exposés of Planned Parenthood, but instead are just lies and distortions. This time the issue is the claim that cutting Medicaid off to Planned Parenthood patients will keep those patients from getting care from their usual provider of gynecological services. This claim is what we in the real world call common sense. If you go to a certain clinic for care and that clinic shuts down, you can no longer go there for care. But Rose wants to claim that this is a lie because some of the patients are on Medicaid and they can go somewhere else in theory. The latest video shows the CEO of Planned Parenthood, Cecile Richards, saying this.
They write me every day saying, I'm just trying to make ends meet. I can't believe that the state legislature or the U.S. Congress is going to tell me I can't get where I've been going to Planned Parenthood for years for my preventive care, for my birth control, and they're telling me now I can't go to the healthcare provider that I trust with my health.
So let's restate this for utmost clarity. Richard said that she's getting letters from women who go to Planned Parenthood and are concerned that they can no longer go to Planned Parenthood because this ban on Medicaid funding means Medicaid won't pay for it. This is the recording of herself that Rose made that supposedly debunks this claim.
Oh, hi. I just had a question about your Medicaid services.
We are no longer a Medicaid provider.
Is there another clinic that we should try or something else we should...
You need to go to your primary doctor.
But they would be able to provide the same services?
Yeah.
So the claim is Richards was lying when she said Medicaid patients couldn't go to Planned Parenthood anymore. Rose called up and found that Planned Parenthood wouldn't take Medicaid patients anymore. In other words, she proved that Richards was telling the naked, honest truth. The implication here is that the care could easily be replaced with care from somewhere else. But nowhere in her supposed exposé does Rose actually prove this. Her assumption in the phone call she made is that your average patient on Medicaid who goes to Planned Parenthood has access to a private physician who takes Medicaid patients and provides the same services. She offers no proof that this is true. And in fact, it's clear that even the Planned Parenthood she calls is not capable of giving a referral. That's because there often aren't any alternatives. The video also claims that only 1% of Medicaid patients in Indiana go to Planned Parenthood. Even if this is true, and nothing from Lila Rose should be assumed true until it's proven so, so what? A lot of that has to do with the fact that many Medicaid patients are old people, men and children, especially children. The implication that the 1% who use the services of Planned Parenthood don't need them because they're small in number is plain just false. Nearly a million people in Indiana use Medicaid, which means that the supposedly small number of women is actually about 10,000. That's a lot of women in a small state. All that this video proves is that, in desperation, Planned Parenthood is telling Medicaid patients to go to their primary care physicians. This is, in and of itself, not that helpful. Rose doesn't go to a gynecologist, I'm guessing, because if she did, she would know that your gynecologist is an entirely different doctor. And in fact, many of these primary care physicians would, if you came in looking for these services, refer you to Planned Parenthood. But she never actually attempts to do that because it doesn't serve her dishonest, misogynistic agenda. The video also claims that there are 800 alternative Medicaid providers in Indiana for women to go to. Rose is clearly implying that there are 800 gynecologists in the state that take Medicaid patients, because gynecological services are exactly what needs to be replaced. But if you actually look at that number, you'll find out, surprise, surprise, it's a lie. Here's Rachel Maddow explaining who those 800 providers actually are.
Quote, the map, they said, showed health clinics that could bridge the gap if Planned Parenthood lost funding. The list included a Salvation Army addiction center, a homeless shelter, several mental health centers, a juvenile detention center, and the Indiana Women's Prison. So that's the suggestion. Just stop into the women's prison, you guys. I'm sure they'd be glad to have you. Or try the addiction center or the Salvation Army. I hear they are great with pap smears.
Sally Cohn took one for the team and went up against a smug, hateful Lila Rose on Fox News and reiterated the point that having your doctor taken from you isn't all roses and perfume like Rose claims it is.
And two-thirds of these Planned Parenthood clinics are located in communities that are classified as medically underserved, in rural communities where, especially with gas prices and unemployment, it's harder and harder to get these services. So, this is I also want to say the 800 other options that were listed there have included a juvenile detention facility, the Indiana Women's State Prison. These are the options, the alternatives that House Republicans in Indiana have put forward as reasonable alternatives for women in Indiana.
The argument that there are alternatives doesn't even make any sense if you think about it. If there are alternatives to Planned Parenthood on every corner, how does Planned Parenthood get patients at all? Wouldn't women on Medicaid do what women with private insurance usually do, which is go to their private gynecologists? Even without the facts, the underlying assumptions Rose promotes make no sense. In reality, as has been demonstrated on the show over and over, Planned Parenthood is a reliable source of gynecological care, and it's one that primary care physicians refer to, in part because they aren't gynecologists, and in part because they don't have the time or resources to handle the 10,000 new patients that will be foisted on them. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Nazis edition. Think Progress put together a collection of quotes from anti-choice legislators supporting the heartbeat ban in Ohio, just so you could get an earful of how stupid they sound. Robert Mecklenburg went for the Nazi argument.
This way is also to look in the context of Nazi Germany, where, during the 1920s, these were the arguments postulated by the proponents of abortion as the Third Reich was growing in power. Note they will sound very similar to you because they are exactly the same arguments put forth to support the current positions in support of the abortion laws as we have them on the books. What do we hear now? We hear statements such as, there's not enough workers. We don't have enough people working to support our Social Security. We don't have enough people working to support our pension systems. I guess that's what 50 million people lost will do to you.
Actually, the Nazis strengthened laws against abortion, making the punishments more severe. They opposed abortion for the same reasons as Mecklenburg, which is because they wanted more soldiers and workers for the fatherland.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.